Hello, and welcome to Citizens Climate Radio. In this podcast, we highlight people's stories, we celebrate your successes, and together, we share strategies for talking about climate change. I'm your host, Peter Santoscano. Welcome to Episode 10 of Citizens Climate Radio, a project of Citizens Climate Education. This episode is airing on Monday, March 27th, 2017. And it's going to be a very artsy show today. We will have, of course, our normal puzzler question with answers for Charlie. He was a crusty old climate curmudgeon, had a question for us. In the art house, you're going to hear a poem by Clara Fang. You may remember Clara from episode 2. Duh, we are the children. She spoke about her childhood in China. An experience with extreme pollution made a big impact on her. Today, she works as an environmentalist promoting climate solutions, and she is a poet. She will read the poem, Love in the Time of Climate Change. But first, I speak with another artist, a writer with a novel that features climate change in a big way. In his book, Mystery Eternity, novelist Aaron Thier takes readers on a 1,000-year odyssey. The main character calls himself Daniel Defoe. We never learned his real name. Old Dan can't seem to die. I'm not sure if he wants to die, he just never dies. He lives for at least 1,000 years. 5 different narrators in 5 different periods from 1500 to 2500 bump into this traveler. This book is brilliant. It's hilarious. It's deeply moving, weird, and I believe it's essential reading for climate advocates. So, I've invited Aaron to tell me about the book, and he's going to read excerpts for you. Now, my own weird background did not prepare me for climate work, or at least I didn't think it did. When I went to university, I studied English literature, theater, and Bible, and I became a Bible scholar and a storyteller. So you would think, what do I have to contribute to conversations about climate change? I'm not a scientist. I'm not an environmentalist in any traditional sense. Well, turns out storytelling is a very important key to have when talking about climate change. More and more researchers are realizing people don't need more data about climate change. They need to hear from people who they trust. And they need to hear from these people how this data affects them, the emotions that they feel about climate change, and how they're proceeding. They need to see how climate change affects their own lives and things that they're passionate about. So actually, everyday people like you and me, we have a big job in addressing climate change. So storytelling is a very important thing. And for me, I'm interested in all kinds of stories. Stories happening in the world today, definitely stories from the past and lessons that we can learn from them. And I wonder a lot about the future. I'm curious about the future. What's it going to look like? What are they going to say about us? And this is what I love about Aaron's book, Mystery Eternity. It takes place in the past, the present, and the future. It reminds me a little bit of Dickens' A Christmas Carol, where you have the ghost of Christmas past, present, and future. It's like the ghost of climate past, present, and future. It's so lovely, just diving into these different time periods. And so I asked Aaron, first off, if he could describe the book for you, so that you can have a sense of what is this book about?
In my own heart, it's a book about climate change, right? That's not that great a descriptor, of course, because what is a book about climate change really about? Usually when people ask me, I just muddle through a kind of explanation of, oh, there's this immortal sailor and he wanders around the Orinoco on the East Coast for 1,000 years and he encounters young people and he gives them dubious advice. You know, for me, it's a book about climate change in which social and cultural disruptions are a product of climate change. In a sense, they are the disruptions that come from climate change.
When talking about climate change, of course, people are very concerned about fact. And there's been controversy over facts, and people have questioned the facts of climate change. In writing and in fiction, there is fact and there is truth. And what I find so interesting about the characters in this book is they're not always factual. They don't remember what happened so well. They don't have all the records of history. But although they don't have the facts right, there's real truth to what they're saying.
Well, I suppose you say I never have to have any of the narrators make what seems like an editorial observation about climate change, about the changes from one section to another. The structure of the novel does that for me, I hope. And so the narrators are simply free to say the most absurd things about their world. And we sort of always know, well, I hope we can distinguish fact from fiction. This is not an essay. It's an attempt to get at a deeper truth.
Okay, so why don't we just dive right in and hear a little clip from the year 2500. We learn about Daniel Defoe, and we hear about their theories about how the climate got so warm.
We issued into the camel pen, and there was Daniel Defoe. It was the first time I cast eyes on him. He had a superannuated cat named Christopher Smart, who was like a gray carpet with teeth, and he was handsome and there were lights in his eyes, but his chief appeal and the reason for my father's interest in him was that he was said to be 1,000 years old. This was not impossible if you consider that he came from the desert. In very dry air with abundant sun, meat will cure before it spoils, and therefore a human being which is made of meat could theoretically live forever. The marked contrast was that in St. Louis, which was frequently ravaged by pestilences like Nevada fever, even rich people lived only 50 or 60 years. Poor people were lucky to survive into their 30s. If he's as old as he says, my father instructed, he would have known the glory of the United States. He was speaking modern English, and it was an astonishment when Daniel Defoe responded in the same language. His accent was untraceable. He said, "Don't talk to me about glory. Those people were out of their minds. They only cared about whale oil. They lived in tents called wigwams. Their method of gardening was to explode chemical bombs, which killed everything." My father said, "We know about oil. We have books and prospectuses in the palace." But I knew he had not read a prospectus in years. "It wasn't only whale oil," said Daniel Defoe. "It was fossilized oil, too. They pumped it out of the earth and drank it like it was banana beer. They pumped so much out of the ground that the land began to sink, and that's why it seemed like the seas were rising. They also made a special train oil from the fat of a seabird called the great auk, which was the national bird of the United States. Train oil made the economy boom, but it also caused global warming because it released all the heat that would otherwise have stayed inside the auks, which were Arctic birds and very warm inside, in any way extremely numerous." This was not true. It was a feast of lies. However, my father devoured it, and I think this marked the sea change for him.
The narrator of that section, Princess Jasmine, is probably one of my favorites, although I love them all, and I really like this character, Jam, in the year 2200. Aaron will tell us about Jam and where he comes from and what he's all about, and then we'll hear directly from the character.
In general, as a kind of travelogue, this young man kind of sails down the East Coast with Daniel Defoe, who points out various features of the United States and remembers things in his idiosyncratic way. In general speaking, it's about this young man trying to wake up from the American dream, I guess, and come to terms with the fact that he is poor and staying poor. There's no path for him. The cities of the Atlantic coast are sort of half underwater. By 2500, they're all underwater and they're gone. But here things are in flux and we see things kind of falling apart. "It were just another morning, nothing unusual, same headache, same sadness, same poverty. But suddenly I were so tired of it all. Suddenly I couldn't stand it. I had never been out of Boston, I had never thought of leaving, but when I seen the boats, yachts, ships headed God knows where, to New York, to Baltimore, suddenly I were asking each captain, was he hiring? One captain told me, yes, he were hiring, yes, and this were how it happened. Strange thought, you could say I were gone 10 years, because one night I were drinking corn whiskey, and in the morning I walked down to the water and not up the hill as I did on other days. These are what is called vicissitudes. I remember it were a cool day, light breezes, long shadows. I wore my sweatshirt even, it were so cool. It were January, the year 2200. It had just begun a new century. My name, it were Jam, it still is. It were never Jim, as some think. I were ignorant of yachts, sails, waves, winds, the sea, and for many days my only concern were learning the ropes. It were truly learning the ropes, not just an expression, for there was ropes to pull on. I were learning which ones. It had an old sailor who taught me. They called him Old Dan. Good gravy, said Old Dan, you don't know nothing. I admit it were the truth. In Boston, I had got my money selling salvage, plastic, fruits, whatever I could find, but I had never learned no true skills. I had never learned to sail.
So I've read Aaron's book about three times now. It's very playful, and as you can see, it also gets serious, and it actually gets quite profound at times. In reading it more than once, I began to notice references are repeated in the different time periods. For instance, both cashew wine and camels come up a lot.
Well, cashew wine just seemed really delicious to me. You know, the cashew nut is not a... I don't know if it's actually the seed. Maybe it is the seed. It grows on the top of this fruit, and then there's this accessory fruit, which is said to be delicious, but I've never tasted it. So it was this... you know, it sounded like this wonderful thing to me. Also, if you say you're drinking cashew wine in St. Louis in the year 2500, there's a moment of defamiliarization, I hope. Camels have always been part of these kind of utopian schemes. They successfully introduced camels to the Australian outback, and there were plans to introduce camels to the American West also. That I think were less successful. But that might have been because Americans, you know, hate camels for some insane reason. Who knows? But camels are these marvelous creatures, and camel milk is said to be very nutritious, and it seems like in the time to come when the West goes to desert and so on, a creature that will give you milk and doesn't have to drink any water ever can get all its water from vegetation. You know, that seems like a great thing to get behind.
In the novel, we learn that Daniel Defoe is on a great quest. He's not looking for fame, fortune, or riches. He's in search of Anna Gloria, his great love. Still, riches do come up in the different time period. What's interesting is in the past and in the future, what's valuable is very different. Jam tells us a bit about what he finds valuable in the year 2200.
Old Dan, however, he cared nothing for riches. He were after another kind of riches. He were after a woman. She was called Anna Gloria. She was his long-lost love. I thought of pearls, too, and rhinestones and gold jewels, plastic. I were carried away by this dream of riches. I used to lie in my berth thinking of the rich men in Boston which had motored boats and drank clear water out of plastic bottles, a fresh bottle every day. It had semi-trailers that delivered them boxes of fruit, vegetables, bread, butter, milk, oil, cream. The truck were cold, so this food didn't spoil. The rich people could have whatever foods they like any time, any day. They was like kings. Their houses was cold also. It were called air condition. It were a old, very expensive technology. You run it off sun panels, or you run it off electricity if you can pay the carbon tax. It were a terrible thing, electricity, air condition, trucks, and the rest. It were the cause of all our ills. It were the electricity plus motor vehicles plus factories plus cows caused climate warming, they said. However, I did not care. I wanted very much to be rich, to lie in bed shivering, drinking water from a plastic bottle. It would taste so sweet. What did I care about climate warming? I would have air condition. I would have sun panels everywhere, on my cars, on my gazebo, on my dog. I would have a plastic bathtub. I would pay the carbon tax without a care. I would be so rich.
Aaron writes about extinctions. They come up in strange in-and-out ways throughout the novel. He'll reference carrier pigeons. He referenced the great ox. I didn't actually know a lot about the great ox, but about the same time I read Aaron's book, I met Kay Kramer. She's local to where I live. Kay is concerned about climate change and just joined the Citizens Climate Lobby group. She wrote an article for the newspaper about an experience with a story and how reading this story as a young person changed the way she views the world and has given her a lifelong passion. This is what Kay wrote. After all these years, I remember how I felt as a sixth grader reading a library book. It told the story of the very last great ox. Black and white, like penguins, and almost 3 feet tall, this flightless seabird nested in Iceland, Greenland, and other North Atlantic islands. Back then, most people didn't believe an animal could ever go extinct. They never set quotas or monitored the flock. I got to the last page of the book and learned that on July 3rd, 1844, three hunters set out to collect specimens for a merchant. They strangled to death the very last mating pair. The pair were incubating an egg. One of the hunters crushed this egg with his boot. He was unaware that his was the final act that led to the extinction of the great auk. I sat holding the book and cried. The story has stayed with me for life. Stories have the power to move us emotionally and move us to action. So I asked Aaron, why did you write your book? And why now?
When it becomes a story about climate change, how do you tell that story? I mean, for example, a story about malaria is not going to be a story about the life cycle of the malarial plasmodium, right? Or if it is, that's going to be a metaphor. What you're really talking about are the real world manifestations, you know, the impact on human experience and so on. And with climate change, the issue is that this is a process, an enormous Earth-sized process unfolding very rapidly in geological terms, but still at something like the pace of a human life, and humans are so good at ignoring things and forgetting things, just as a matter, I think, of psychological preservation in a way. So how do you communicate a sense of emergency, a sense really that this is what you're talking about? I don't have an explanation for why novelists don't really address this question very directly and why people don't seem to respond to it. I mean, to me, it seems absolutely the most important thing in the world, but I don't know. I mean, I guess in a sense, that's why I wrote the book, to try to communicate this sense of emergency. Now I will tell more of old Dan. "He were a very old man, maybe 750 years old," he said. "I did not believe him, yet still he were very old, like a piece of meat salted down for keeping. One day he talked of whales. I did not believe him, once again, for I did not believe in whales. There were no reason for an animal to grow so big when it were so good to be a small animal, a cockroach, a rat, which can live on crumbs. He laughed. He said the whales, they lived on crumbs too, only it were giant crumbs, for to them a ship like ours were a crumb. Fine, I said, whatever you say. You don't believe me, he said. No, I said. The biggest were 400 feet long, he said. They could swallow our boat entire. Did you not ever see a picture? For there was many pictures. Yes, I said, I had got a picture book of animals when I were young in the orphan house. However, I believe the pictures was faked. How could you fake a picture? He said, it is a picture. They could find a way, I said. No, he said, it can't be done. I didn't listen to him. I thought he were a fool. You will see I had got it wrong. He were no fool. For example, it were him taught me to write. Anyway, there you have it. That were how I come to leave home at the age of 18 or 19 years.
That's Aaron Thier reading from his novel, Mr. Eternity. The book was published by Bloomsbury and is available wherever books are sold. You may want to check out the excellent audiobook version over at audible.com. It is the single best audiobook I have ever heard. The actors, oh my gosh, they're just so amazing. You can learn more about Aaron at his site, aaron-thier.com. That's spelled Aaron, A-A-R-O-N, Thier, T-H-I-E-R, aaron-thier.com. Or just search for Aaron, Mr. Eternity. You will find him and the book. Very special thanks to Aaron for joining us here at Citizens Climate Radio and for a reading from Mr. Eternity. Now go out and get your own. Now it's time for the Art House. We continue a literary theme with our featured artist. Joining us in the Art House is Clara Fang. Clara is a writer, environmentalist, and a photographer currently based in Detroit, Michigan. She's also the higher education liaison at Citizens Climate Lobby. Her poems have been published in numerous journals. She's been nominated for a Pushcart Prize, she won the Lyric Poetry Contest, and was a finalist for the Benjamin Saltman Poetry Award. Clara was born in Shanghai, China, and immigrated to the United States when she was 9 years old. Clara shares with us one of her poems, a love poem.
Love in the Time of Climate Change. When the buildings are decked with seaweed and fish fly out of the windows, will you stand with me on high ground? When the forests are ash and the birds have silenced their song, will you sing to me all night long? When the glaciers are dry rock and the fertile valleys Saharas, will your mouth be enough for my mouth? Will you tell me the stories of creation as it unravels back into the ocean? Will you hold my hand as I am about to drown? Intelligent one, when I look at you, all the children of the universe look through your eyes. In this life and others, I have loved them all. Will we hold them close against the rising waters and make an ark to shelter the storm? Will you catch me before the fall?
Thank you so much, Clara. You can read Clara's poetry and her essays on sustainability at her website. Just visit residenceonearth.net. That's residenceonearth.net. If you have an idea for the Art House, feel free to contact me, radio@citizensclimate.org. radio@citizensclimate.org. And before we end this episode, it is time for the Citizens Climate Puzzler. Last month, you met crusty old Charlie at a meeting with other climate advocates. Charlie has grown weary after years of climate inaction. You all just heard a presentation about the need to build on shared values with lawmakers and leaders in the fossil fuel industry. Charlie blurts out, "Shared values? Sorry, that's my crusty old voice. Shared values, really? These are determined folks we're up against. They don't play nice. We're not going to win by playing nice with them." So what do you say to crusty old Charlie? I heard from a lot of you. Thank you for all of your responses. Don Schold from Stillwater, Minnesota has this answer. "Thank you, Charlie, for your inspired, passionate, and unwavering anger. Were it not for voices like yours, the opposition would never have agreed to come to the table to engage in conversation with us equally passionate but more reserved advocates." I also heard from Thomas H. Pritchard of the Department of Chemical and Physical Sciences at Cedarcrest College in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Thomas writes, "I would tell Charlie that yes, there are some in the denier world we can never reach until they are finally ready to listen. However, there are still many people out there who are either on the fence or have views that have not locked into stone. Those who you are trying to reach, and you can only do that by interacting with them and others in a respectful manner. Remember, the person you ultimately reach may not be the person you are directly engaging, but the bystander who is silently listening to the whole dialogue." Thank you, Don, Thomas, and all the other folks who answered the puzzler question. So, you ready for our new question? I asked a question similar to this one a few months ago. It is perhaps the most important question for climate advocates to answer. Believe it or not, many people are not at all that concerned about animal extinctions or the plight of future generations. For them, there needs to be another climate hook, one that is closer to home. So here is your puzzler. Besides the welfare of animal species and future generations, why are you passionate about climate change? I'd love to hear from a lot of people about this one. It is an important story you can tell others. Here's the question again. Besides the welfare of animal species and future generations, why are you passionate about climate change? Send me your answers, leave your name, contact info, and where you are from. Get back to me by April 15th, 2017. You can email your answers to radio@citizensclimate.org. That's radio@citizensclimate.org. You can also text me or leave a voicemail. I love the voicemails, of 3 minutes or less at the following number. You ready? 570-483-8194. +1 if calling from outside the USA. That number again is 570-483-8194. Thank you for joining me for this episode of Citizens Climate Radio. If you like what you hear, feel free to share the show with your friends. Here's something you can do, actually. If you're in the car with someone and have about 30 minutes, say, "Hey, I have a podcast I'd love you to hear," and then hit play. The show is written and produced by me, Peter Santoscano, technical support from Ricky Bradley, social media assistance from Ashley Hunt Monterano, Flannery Keck, and Steve Volk, moral support from Madeline Pera. All of the music we use on the show is licensed unless otherwise specified. Special music for the Art House segment includes One Suite from the free 1920s collection on archive.org. There are lots of ways you can share Citizens Climate Radio with your friends. Just look for Citizens Climate Lobby on iTunes, Podbean, and Stitcher Radio. You can also listen at northernspiritradio.org. Join the discussion at our Facebook group page, facebook.com/groups/Citizens Climate Radio. And finally, you can follow us on Twitter at Citizens C Radio. That's Citizens, the letter C, Radio, Citizens C Radio on Twitter. Visit ccl.podbean.com to see info about our puzzler and find links to our guests. That's ccl.podbean.com. On the right, you will see Citizens Climate Radio listed under categories. Citizens Climate Radio is a project of Citizens Climate Education. I look forward to hearing from you and to getting together again real soon.
Hi, this is Tony Bufuzio from the Bronx. It seems like there's a little time at the end of the show. Maybe I could say something. I don't know. I've been hearing a lot about climate change. One thing I noticed about climate change, it's a lot of polar bears. Polar bear imagery has exploded on the internet. And these photographers, they're amazing. They take these photos and you see these polar bears. They look so sad. They look so forlorn. Like, you want to go over and hug them or something, but no. You better not hug them. They're going to rip you to shreds. Still, it's really sad, right? These polar bears, they're losing their habitats and shrinking, right? And so they can't go off and murder seals like they like to do. They like to murder seals. So now what's happening is they're crawling onto land, right, where people live, and they're going around in people's garbage cans. Polar bears have become the raccoons of Alaska. It's disgusting. Now, I don't like polar bears. They're gross and they're dangerous. Yeah, but the problem is the climate isn't just warming up in the Arctic. It's also warming in Central America, where there's this disease, this fungus, and it's spreading like wildfire, attacking coffee plants. Yeah, it's called coffee leaf rust. Look it up. It's on the Wikipedia, wherever. Now this is going to sound terrible. Don't judge me, but you know what? I think I could live without polar bears. But a world without coffee? No. That's a dystopian future that I just can't face. This is Tony Bufuzio. Hopefully they'll let me on for reals, not just as a little tag at the end.